So, herzlich willkommen hier Gulasch Programmiernacht 2024, die 22. GPN. Wir haben hier ein Talk zu einem sehr spannendem Thema, der sehr viele Leute hier in den Saal geführt hat, und wir sind schon seit mehreren Minuten unter uns, weil die Türen zu sind und der Talk überfüllt ist. Und deswegen ohne viel weiter durch meine kurze Sprechpause, damit der gute Schnitt klappt, und dann übergebe ich an dich.
Willkommen zu meinem Lean Talk. In Lean können wir richtig komische Sachen machen. Ich habe schon vorhin ein bisschen erzählt, dass ich gerne so richtig cursed Sachen mache mit Typsystemen in C-Sharp oder Rust. Und das geht nur bedingt gut in C-Sharp oder Rust. Rust ein bisschen besser, aber wir wollen dennoch irgendwie den Compiler dazu benutzen, um uns zu helfen, damit der Compiler uns guiden kann. I should be giving this talk in English because I was advertised. Great apologies to anyone on the stream. I am terribly sorry. Okay, let's... I love doing cursed things with types in Rust and in C#. That's only possible to some degree in C#. A little bit better in Rust, but still, there was something missing in my life: the juice of dependent types. And eventually, I went. I found Idris. Could do some fun stuff with Idris. I did some stuff with Isabel. But eventually, I settled with Lean because it's got one of the best compilers and one of the most cozy environments that you can program in. The tooling is amazing. It's nonetheless a new language, so the ecosystem isn't that great, but it's very rapidly developing. And this will be an intro to both Lean, but also the theory behind it and what makes it amazing. So Lean is a theorem prover and a programming language. One of its explicit goals is that it's also a programming language. So it's not just a theorem prover, like Isabel is predominantly a theorem prover. So Lean is written in itself, to a testament to the fact that you can use it as a programming language. It's based on the calculus of inductive constructions, which we will talk about later. And one of the hallmarks of it are dependent types, which is basically that. We'll see how we can encode propositions, so arbitrary math formulas, into the type system, which might sound weird at first, like a type is int. How can we encode formulas with that? But we can do that, and it's really cool. And we'll see how that goes. A short outline for the talk. We'll give a very short intro to how Lean looks like, just the hello world. We'll talk about the one and only example of dependent types. Sorry, not one and only. The only one that's used in papers when you read any, which is VEC. We'll talk about how propositions as types work. And then my two favorite chapters, types as first-class objects and metaprogramming, because that's where you can do the weird stuff that I love doing so much. Feel free to ask some questions. I hope I'll manage the time right, but feel free to ask some questions. And I have a lot of code. This is the only talk heavy slide. The rest is basically only code. So there'll be a lot of Lean and there'll be some Rust. Feel free to ignore the Rust if it bothers you. Some hello world. Since Lean is a functional programming language, one of the things we see is that it is white space sensitive. So we have code blocks that are just indented. Another important feature is that we have function application syntax, so just calling a function with three arguments, we can get the weather for the state. In a C-like language, you do this with parentheses and then commas in between. And the value that getWeather returns, well, weather can only be sunny or rainy, we all know that, there's nothing else. So in a C-like language, we model that as an enum. So these are the variants, or for a Lean talk, the term constructor is more appropriate. So you can, by using sunny, you can get the weather. By using rainy, you can also get the weather. C can also do this. In some languages, we can also associate those with data, but that will come in a second. And then once we have an enum, we can pattern match on it. So the counterpart to enum is match. In Lean, we don't even write that because it's so common that it's just built into the syntax for defining functions. So we can just pattern match on the weather. In some languages, we can also carry data with a variant, but only one variant. So if the weather is rainy, we also get the amount of rain that there is on that day. And by pattern matching on rainy, we get the we bind a variable here, that's the amount of liters that it has rained. We also have if expressions. So depending on the condition, this expression evaluates to very or nothing and gets assigned to the let binder. And we don't have return statements at the end. So we just have the last statement is the return value. That's it. On the left-hand side, you can see the equivalent Rust code. Yes, you can do the Rust code a little bit simpler, but in general, these are equivalent, yes. Now, a thing that Rust cannot do. In Rust, you usually have numbers that are bounded, like U32. There's 32 bits in it. In Lean, we can do something much cooler. We can do the unbounded natural numbers. But OK, so if you were to do that, it would be an enum with an infinite amount of constructors. But we can do collapse that into just two constructors by saying, OK, we define the set N inductively. And that is why it is not called enum, but it's called inductive. So we postulate that 0 is a natural number. And then given any other natural number, the successor of that, whatever successor means, it's just a constructor with no interpretation. It's just the successor of N is also a natural number. And that way we can inductively define the set N. Something is missing here because these kind of remind you of Peano axioms, and we only have specified two of them. The other one are missing. All right. Some examples. Here we have the number 2. Here we have 3. You just count the amount of successors, and that's how you get numbers. Then we can define addition on numbers, and we define addition recursively. So we don't do bit vector. We don't do 32 length bit vectors that we add, but instead we do we pattern match on this representation that is basically a linked list with no data in it, and we can pattern match on the left hand side. And you can see that with my beautiful colors, that you just need to follow the colors. So X becomes the first argument to add. And then the second argument, we see that, OK, the second case is the case. And we destructure it. And we replace the left-hand side with the right-hand side. And we just compute like this. So this is one step in add. We have, in general, we have recursive functions in Lean, as in most other pure functional programming languages. And we just recurse until we reach a fully reduced form where add is no longer in the term, so at the end. And that's obviously 5 because we count 5 sucks here. Instead of pattern matching, we can also define a function via just a lambda. I will not be talking much about lambdas. It's just, if you don't know what a lambda is, it's essentially just a closure, just without any state or other stuff like that. So we define a constant myfunc that is of type function type, and a function is of type function type, so we just, this is the right-hand side of it. We can evaluate this as well here. And the way we evaluate that is first we expand the definition, and that it becomes its right-hand side, which is the lambda that we have defined. And then we can reduce the lambda, so the 2 goes into this n. And then we can use the same thing we did up here to reduce it. That's just the basics of functional programming languages. Notice also here that even though add is defined recursively, we know that it terminates. Because every recursive occurrence of add is, OK, x is the same, and y is smaller. So we know that add terminates. We can also replace the left-hand side with the right-hand side during type checking, which will become important later. We can also expand definitions during type checking, and we can even reduce, yes, even recursive functions during type checking. We will see that in action very soon. We have lists, and this is probably nothing new to most people who actually knows how lists work in Haskell or Lean or something like that. It's basically a linked list. I assume everyone knows that. So it's very similar to NAT. You have nil or list to list, except it also carries data. That's about it. All right. What if you wanted to define vector addition? What you could do is you could say, okay, well, I'm going to define add 3 for just a 3-element vector. But then, oh, well, now I need an add 4 and so on. And now you can start copy-pasting it. But eventually, you're going to realize, well, it's kind of bored of copy-pasting. Let's implement it with lists instead. So, and then you run into a problem that, well, what if a user supplies a 3-element list here and a 4-element one here? What do you do then? All functions in Lean are total, so we need to return something. But what do you return? In a language like Rust, you would throw an exception or panic, but you cannot do that in Lean. So what do you do? Well, you don't do this at all. That's the answer. Instead, you use a vector where we parameterize the length of the list into the type of the list itself. And very fittingly, we call it vec then. So the green stuff here is the new stuff, and we can see that we postulate that nil is a vector of zero length, and if we have a vector that is length n, we append something to it, then obviously the length increases by 1. This is n plus 1. And now we can say, okay, well, addition is when we add a vector to another vector, but they have to be the same type. Then we also give a vector that is the same type, that has the length. So we encode preconditions and postconditions in a way that is kind of implicit here. Here's some more examples. So we have a one-length vector by taking a zero-length vector, appending some data to it. A two-length vector, we can append something twice to it, and it's a two-length vector. And if we try to do something illegal, such as saying that, oh, well, I have this nil thing, let's append nothing to it, and just like this is a one-length vector, like please trust me on this, the compiler is going to complain because it's not able to prove that these are the same type, because nil has this type, but we are expecting this type, and those are not the same type. Because vec 0 and vec 1 are different types. So this is actually going to give you a compile error because it doesn't type check. It's not a linter. Let's take this for a spin. OK, we have, we want to double every, for whatever reason, I don't know why, we want to double the every element in a vector. So given a vector, the resulting vector will obviously have double the length. All right, well, right, there's something weird going on here. First of all, we have a type, right? This whole thing is a type, and it depends on its first argument. So the type depends on a value on the first argument, and this is what a dependent type is. And even weirder, we have this type, which depends on a function of the first argument. Like, what's the limit here? Can we put arbitrary functions into types which depend on other values? And okay, well, what's the limit? Basically, yes, you can put arbitrary things in there, and you can even look into the definitions as we saw on the previous slide, and then reason about that like that. And let's do that just now. Okay, so what do we need to implement double? We need to, let's pattern match on n. So we case split or pattern match on n, and n is either 0 or it's 1 plus some other number. And if it's 0, oh wait, the type of v is now known better. We know that here v is 0, so it's a 0-length vector. And just like that, here it is a vector that has at least one element. Okay, so this is dependent pattern matching, and by pattern matching on this element, which is a value, we are able to refine the type of the second
argument, which is very handy because now we can say, oh, well, this is, there's only one way to construct a zero length vector. It's the only way here. And a one length vector is the only way to construct it there. We can refine those. We can obtain data that way. And similarly, we can also refine the return type. And now, because it was a function, we know that the return type of, in the first case, is 2 times 0. OK, well, as a human, obviously, we know that this is just 0, right? So we can just write nil here. And because we are able to peek into the definitions of functions, so into the definition of multiplication, which is just a recursive function as well, we are actually indeed able to compute this to this type. So we are able to prove that vec 2 times 0 is the same type as vec 0. And because of that, we can close this with just nil. Similarly, but a bit more involved, in the second case, where before we had this expression, this is 2 times n plus 1, we can transform that by using this obvious identity into those two suck constructors here. And well, we know how to implement both of those cases. This obviously has to be nil, and this has to be 2 times the const thing. These underscores are just a technicality because we are able to infer the concrete value of that here. And then we call it recursively, and double m x's has this type. Well, it's a vector a of 2 times m. And this definition type checks. And if we had screwed something up along the way, Lin would have actually complained. So what we have done here is we have encoded a precondition, which is kind of obvious here because it works for an arbitrary n. But we have also encoded a postcondition, 2 times n, into the type system. And this is done in a rather implicit way. So how far can we take this? Can we encode arbitrary pre and post conditions into the type system? Yes, we can. Let's take that for a spin. So what does this code do? We have a dragon which has a name and an amount of coins. But we want to enforce that all dragons have at least 1,000 coins. And the way you would do this in a normal, in a programming language like Rust or C#, is you would have a constructor which does that check. And if that check fails, you throw an exception, or in Rust, you panic. In Lean, all functions are total, so we need to return something. So we need to return some dummy value. So we just return some dummy value here in red. A slightly safer way, without throwing exceptions or dummy values, is to return an option. So if the check fails, we return none instead. And if the check passes, we return some. The problem is that now we return option. And every time the constructor is called, you need to check whether the constructor has actually succeeded, which is maybe something we want to avoid. So, okay. But also, once we have constructed a dragon, we want to somehow give that as an invariant to whoever whoever uses dragons. So what you could do is you could write a comment here saying, oh, yeah. Like, coins is always bigger than 1,000, but that's just a comment. And this is a simple example. Someone might forget that eventually, and then you have some problem. So one way to make the compiler help you is to encode this invariant not as a comment, but make it explicit and encode it as a proposition. So in order to construct a dragon, you need to also give it a proof that the invariant is met. So okay, now we need to construct not just name coins, but also we need to somehow prove that this condition is met. And how do we do that? Well, I mean, we have just done the check here. So we actually do have a proof. And Lean has a syntax for that, where we can obtain a proof from an if that this thing is actually coins is at least 1,000. And then we can construct the dragon. And otherwise, we cannot. But we still need to return option. And maybe we want to get rid of that. So, how else can we obtain this proof? Let's ask the user to give it to us. So we just ask it as one of the parameters. I might have forgotten to explain this. This is carrying syntax. This is the first parameter type. This is the second. This is the third. This is our return value. So we just ask for a parameter which we don't name here. We could have named it as well, but we don't need to name proofs. And if the user is unable to give us a proof, we just refuse to be called. So new says, no, you cannot call me because you forgot to give me a proof. And now we don't need to return option, and actually, oh, this is just the constructor for Dragon that we had used before. So the general idea is to make it impossible to construct bad state. And all of these checks are not a linter. If they fail, the compiler will actually complain to you. So far we have done some examples, but in order to encode arbitrary formulas, we need to have arbitrary formulas. So how do we do that? Let's start with the simple cases. And in this case, I have some. In this case, instead of type, you will often see prop. These are the same thing. The difference for us is mostly irrelevant. Haha, proof irrelevant. Funny. It makes some things easier for the purposes of this talk. It's not that important. Mostly, it's just for documentation in this talk that this is supposed to be a proposition. Okay. And I kind of want to make this a little interactive. How do you construct truth? Okay, well, this one's easy. Well, there's only one way to construct truth. You don't get anything. You don't get anything back out. It's just trivial to prove true. All right. You can also do this in Rust, actually. It's just an empty struct, right? All right. How do you construct falsehood? Yes? Yes, exactly. So that's it. And you can do this in Rust as well. You can have an enum with no variants, so no ways to introduce, to construct false. That's sometimes known as the exclamation mark in Rust or just the empty type. Unless, obviously, you have an infinite loop, then oops. If you tried the same thing in Lean, you would actually get a complaint from the compiler saying that, oh no, we're unable to prove the termination for this. Because, well, we cannot postpone, if we postpone the proof until forever, we would just never be done. But in Lean, all functions need to terminate. Otherwise, we would be able to accept this. Yes? OK, so the general idea is that propositions are, and I think I forgot to explain this, and this is very central to the idea, I'm sorry. Propositions are types. And proofs of a propositions are value of the type. And the idea is that you can only construct a type when it's true. So if you're unable to construct a type, it's supposed to be false. And so you only can construct the truth statements that you want to be able to construct. And false, you just cannot construct it. Because if you cannot have a proof, so a value of the type, it's not possible to construct it. It's false.
Why doesn't it exist
anymore? You can have false without it being able to be proven. You can never construct it, obviously. You can have it as a type. That doesn't mean that the type is inhabited. It doesn't mean that the type has any values in it. Because later on, we want to be able to state things such as, okay, 5 is smaller than 2, which is not a true statement, but we can state that as a statement that has no proof. Yeah, we can also eliminate false, and from that we can prove an arbitrary proposition. This is how we eliminate branches. That will become obvious later. So how do we construct conjunctions, so AND? Well, if the only way to make something true is to have a value of it, then, well, in order to prove something of AND, we need the value of A and we need the value of B. So in Rust, in struct syntax, it's like this. And you could write the same thing in Lean as well. Lean also has a structure keyword. But I chose to make it more apparent here with you need to give it an A and a B, and then that way you can construct A and B. And now the question is, how do you do that for disjunction? So, okay, if I want to say A or B, how can I construct that? Yes. Yes, exactly. Because we can either construct OR with the A proof, and that is sufficient to prove A or B, Or if we give it a proof of B, then we can construct a proof of A or B nonetheless, but we only needed B. And there you go, that's the solution. And we can pattern match on this. And if proofs are values and we have function values, then the proof of an implication is the function itself. So let's say we want to prove A or B implies B or A. This is true for any concrete A or B. And this is just a function. If this junction is A, then we just swap it around. If it's B, then we swap it around as well. And you can even execute this function. You can run it. And the thing that becomes more apparent if you look at the Rust code over here on the left. All right. And we have actually seen this type before as well. We have, this was the constructor for dragons where we required this proof. And here, okay, well, if you read this, it'll become apparent what this is. And there's a small spoiler on the slide as well. If you give me a string, any string, like an arbitrary string, if you give me an arbitrary number, and if you give me a proof, then this function will construct you a dragon. All right, I think it makes a bit more sense if we replace it with a proposition at the end. So if you give me an arbitrary string, in this case it's irrelevant actually, and if you give me some number, an arbitrary number, such that this is true for a number, you know, then I will construct you, then this new function will construct you a proof of this statement. So this is, if you read it differently, just a for-all quantifier. And lean actually has no difference between function types and the for-all quantification. It's the same thing in lean. And more generally in the calculus of inductive constructions. So all of these syntaxes are basically the same thing. Or literally the same thing, actually. We can prove a function type by showing that a function of this type exists. So the way to prove a for-all quantifier is just a function. We can use that, that's modus ponens, just by applying the function p, this thing, to some arguments. And I think this makes it most clear. It's a for-all quantifier because for any C that I input there, I can obtain a proof of the right-hand side where the C is inserted. So if I pick 500 here, then this 500 will go in here, and then I can obtain a proof of this implication, and then if I also prove this thing by omega, that's just a cheat, don't worry about it, then we can obtain this thing as well. So that's modus ponens, or using for all quantifiers. Let's say we want to parse a string, a vector concretely, that is given to us in string form. Well, what's the return type of that? Well, we need to give something in here, otherwise it doesn't make any sense because we have parameterized the type by the by the length of it. Well, okay, well, let's just give it some n that we introduce as a new parameter. But now we need to give the length of the vector before we even call parse. That's not that great, because maybe the user inputs 9. But if the user inputs 9, then we know how long the resulting vector is already. So let's return a pair of the length and a vector of that length. But now we just need to make this thing depend on this. Just how do we do that? Well, we just give it a name, and then we can depend on this. And this is exactly what we do here. This is a dependent pair. So now, parse returns both the length that it has parsed and a vector of that length. The syntax up here is dependent pair, where it's a pair of A and B, which is of the type that where B depends on the value of A. The syntax is similar to the pair notation, except we can give a name to the first one because we need to use it in the type of B already. And what we can do here is we can invoke parse, and we get the length of that out. And we get that even for user supplied stuff. So this is not something you can do in Rust with const generics, for example, where every function needs to be monomorphized. So the compiler needs to generate a function for a very concrete n. And in lean, we can do better, where even though it's read from at runtime, we can still return, we can still make this type check because, well, no matter which n, no matter which length it is, we return the length, and the second type depends on that. And no matter what the n is, it's all fine, and it's okay to generate code for that. And then we just return, print how many elements there were. And now, okay, what if the second one is a proposition, actually? Then we can only construct the first one if we can also provide a proof of the proposition. So what we can do with this is we can make a subtype. So I'm going to skip over this. We can make, for example, fin, which is only the set of values 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, that is fin 4, because it's all natural numbers for which we can also provide or also construct a proof of this proposition. And surprisingly, maybe, is we can also interpret this as an existential quantifier if we choose to make the whole thing a proposition. So there's not much difference between subtype and existential quantifiers. And we have seen the less than or equal to proposition before, and we can actually implement that as an inductive predicate as well. So we have this relation, which is a set with a bunch of two-element things in it, where we postulate that, okay, well, for any x, x is smaller than or equal to x. This is just how we define it. That's the base case. And then if we have one of those for x is x smaller than or equal to y, then we can increment y by 1, and that is also in the relation. So that's how we define that. And we can look at some examples here. So there is def here. You could have also written theorem here. It makes no difference. And we can prove this just by saying, okay, same two. Because if we put two in here, we get exactly this type out. And notice that I have implicitly done some syntactic sugar here. This is obviously this symbol. I hope that doesn't make any problems for anyone. We can do some more stuff. We can prove two is smaller than or equal to four by saying, okay, we start with two, and then we increase the second one until it becomes four by two steps. And obviously this is very laborious. If you do it this way, nobody would ever actually do this. Instead, you have tactics, which I'm not going to explain here actually, that take this and make it automated away. Let's try doing something illegal. Let's say one is smaller than or equal to zero. And this is a type that is impossible to construct a proof for. Well, let's try constructing a proof for it anyway. Well, okay, the only ways we can construct this is construct it is by same or step. Well, step is same fails because, well, we are expecting one smaller than or equal to zero, but same has this type, as you can read here. So these are not the same type. So type checker says, nope, you cannot do this. And it says that still if we try same one. And we cannot, so this is obviously not going to work. So this is bad, forbidden. You can let your creativity go a little wild by devising all kinds of other inductive predicates. For example, you can say, okay, well, this string is valid JSON, only if it is shaped in one of the following ways. And one of those ways is, okay, maybe it's an array. Then you need those things. And the good thing is about this, if you have a string such that subtype, such that it is a valid, such that it is valid JSON, then when you pattern match on the string and on the proof that it is valid JSON, you obtain more knowledge about how the string is actually made up. So that way you can eliminate edge cases and make sure that, and the compiler is giving you a guarantee that it is a correctly formed string. Because you know, it must have been introduced using only one of these few ways. And now the best part of the talk. Let's make some type-safe SQL queries. I'm gonna take a small sip. So we have our entity here. That's a dragon. It has an ID, name, and some coins. I ignored the constraint that coins need to be at least 1,000. That's not gonna be relevant anymore. And we have a sample table data. Have a sample table data over here, there, where we have, okay, well, this is ID, this is the name, this is the amount of coins. That's one entity, here's the other one, and so on. It's just a list. And, okay, well, we want to obviously make a projection from the dragons table, and we only want the first two columns, or only the ID column and the coins column. But what should the return type be? Cannot use dragon again, or well, we can. If we made everything an option, then we can just say, well, okay, we just make name none, and that's it. But the problem is, if you want one such entity for all your entities without duplicating the structure by a huge amount of times, you cannot have a guarantee anymore that ID and coins are not none. But you want to have that. So this is maybe suboptimal. So let's try doing something better. It would be ideal if we could map types to other types. So, and this is not something you can do, at least not directly, but okay, let's entertain this idea anyway. We want to map, and I have rewritten dragon here as just a pair or a triple of these three types. So we want to map this type to our projected type, where we only give the two fields, the zeroth field and the tooth field, to as the fields that we want out of it. But we are mapping type to type, and you cannot do that, not even in lean. So what we can do instead is, okay, well, we can return types in lean. That is fine. So instead, we define our type codes. So these are just values. Num and str are just enum variants. But we can interpret these enum variants to the actual real types that they denote. And obviously, these do not capture all possible ways that an SQL data type looks like. But this is just an example. But now we have a finite amount of constructors that we know describe our data type. And we can take this a step further, and by saying, okay, a list of those things denotes a tuple or triple, and so on. That's the type of the table, so to speak. And here, this is a function defined recursively on the list of the codes. If it's empty, we just return unit. That's the trivially provable or trivially constructible type, just because we need to, we need to map nil to something. And if we have another type, then we just map that, and we map the tails to the recursive invocation. This is lift one that refers to this. Some examples. We map lift of an empty type code list to just unit. For multiple, we map it to this essentially tuple if you ignore it. Essentially pair if you ignore the technicality thing here. So now what we have is, okay, we know what the input is, what the input type is. It's this thing here. It's a list of lift, blah, blah, blah. And we can use lift as if it was a type. We can, and we know what the output type is supposed to be just by looking at it. We're still designing how this is supposed to work. We know that, okay, ID and coins are both numbers, so we need two numbers, so we do this. So all we need to do now is just relate the input type code to the output type code. And we do that by saying, well, the output type code is a function of the input type code projected by those fields. Let's implement that. So we map not types themselves, but we map the type codes, and we can interpret those type codes before and after. So let's implement proj. So we give an input of type codes, the fields that we want, that's these, for example, and we get out a list of type codes as well. All right, we just implement that recursively. And well, we descend on the rest, and we yoink out 1f, that's the index into the field, and we have this list index feature, and f is an index into the fields. So for example, 0 refers to this, 2 refers to that, and that way we can compute the output type code, and we can interpret those. So now we have managed to actually relate those things. Obviously, there's a small problem here in that this is just a natural number. What if this is out of bounds? And we can fix that by using fin. And fin is the type that is at most, where we have at most this amount, that's the length. So we know that it is a valid index into TS. And we get that proof that it is a valid index into TS by LT. And we can then use this proof with this apostrophe syntax in order to discharge the obligation that that the index is valid and that no out of bounds is going to occur. And then we can do some renaming in order to make it a little bit nicer to handle, but this is nothing substantial. This thing is the only thing that changed. Instead of having as I had originally, where you had a structure of Dragon, you can no longer have that. Instead, you define your entities by just having the type codes, these things, and then your entity, which is the actual real type, this time for real, just by lifting it. But this way, you get also the being able to relate the type codes by functions. Okay, what we have done so far is we know how the types change. But we haven't actually implemented this yet. So we need to say, we need to find some function from this type to this type down here. So let's do exactly that. So we have a table on the left side, and we need to map it to the table of the right side. We can do this by map, which takes care of the list part. Now we only need to worry about a single row. So a single row is denoted by the type code, but the type of that, so we need to lift it. And we map it to the projection, to the projected thing. And we can do this by pattern matching on the fields. So we need to yoink out. If we need this field, we need to yoink it from here. We know it has the index 0. So if field is 0, then we need to somehow get it. We'll get to that soon. And same for all others. And then we just implement this function recursively. There's something weird going on here in that we have not cons here, but this is not cons here. But instead, we have this tuple syntax. And that is because if ID is 3, name is A, coins is 1,000, then you can see this as a nested tuple. And this way, when we this is row, and we construct the right-hand side by doing the same thing, where we do this thing for one, and so on, and then recurse through that way. And we can implement, but how do we yoink a single element from a whole row? So we essentially need to index not a list, but a tuple, which can have a bunch of different types. But we know how those types look like. because we have the type codes. So we know exactly which index has which type. And we know that if we need something at index field, this is the field, then we know that it's going to return a type, for example, string or not, depending on what is in the type code. So this way we can make it type safe despite having essentially a heterogeneously typed list. And we can iterate on the row by deconstructing it, and we know how it behaves because of because of the type codes, yeah. But okay, well, there's three different branches there. Why is there three branches? Okay, what we're doing is we're essentially implementing the bracket syntax for get. So get is essentially this thing as well, when you have a list. And E is the index, so the field that we want to get. So we just need to count down E until we reach zero and then return that value. And if we haven't reached zero yet, we just descend. And okay, well, the problem is this index needs to be valid, so we need to modify the proof of that. And we can do this with this function, and that is not really relevant right now, but we can make sure that the index remains valid when we descend. And one very nice thing, I would not have actually needed to write this top line here, but I wanted to keep it in anyway, because we actually have three cases where it is possible that we have an empty row, so just a unit, but the index is still some index. Is it possible that this function is called with an index into a empty list? Well, no, it's not possible, because fin is a pair of the index and a proof that that index is smaller than the length of the list. If the length of the list is zero, there is no number that is smaller than zero. So we know that this is not possible. So we can completely erase this branch and say, okay, well, this complete branch is impossible. And we can do that by fin lm0, because we know fin0 is an empty type. And lastly, we get into metaprogramming, and I'm not sure whether I'll have a lot of time to go through that. In Lean, we can introduce arbitrary syntax. We need this because mathematicians love lots of syntax and lots of notations. But we can use that in order to make SQL notation. So, okay, how does a very simple SQL query look like? We can have select, and we have possibly a projection or no projection. No projection if here. And we have from this atom, and then we have some identifier and maybe optionally a where clause, which we'll not go into detail here. The green stuff are parser combinators, so a projection is either no projection or it is some identifier, and actually not one identifier, but a comma-separated list of identifiers. So that's how we can define syntax. There's some shortcuts to this. You can also define notation for vector nil and vector cons. These things do some of custom notation, introduction, and elaboration as well. All right, but you can also have macro rules, which you may know from Rust, but that maps syntax to other syntax. And you cannot do fancy stuff like type inference in your macros, but we can do that during elaboration and when we have metaprograms. You can also have metaprograms here. And here's an example of a metaprogram where we take the syntax and actually map it to a very small minimal core language in Lean that is mostly an inductive type expr. So we take syntax and map it to terms. We can introduce either function elaboration for terms, or we can add it for new commands. You can even introduce new commands. Def and induction are also introducible via this way. So Lean is very extensible. You can do arbitrary stuff in here. And this is no macro. This is actual Lean code. And in this case, we match on syntax with this funky apostrophe syntax. And we can say, OK, well, the syntax that we had defined is SQL syntax. And it's either of this form, and then we do something with it, or it's of this form, and then we do something else with it. And in this case, well, it's just a very simple thing that I return. It's actually, it actually doesn't make much sense. It's just add 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's because metaprogramming itself is untyped. That is not an issue because the expression that we generate is then rechecked by Lean itself to make sure that it's actually well typed. Yeah, and instead of doing it this arduous way, we can just have some quotations, which are gonna introduce the expression that we had seen before. In metaprogramming, we can also do stuff like we can elaborate terms, which go from syntax to expression. We can also infer types. So given an expression already that we had maybe elaborated before, we can ask Lean itself, well, what is the type of that? And we get back another expression, and then we can continue with that. We can do unification as well, so we can check whether two expressions have the same structure, and those expressions might have some holes in them, which then get filled in the process. We can also do stuff like we can read and append environment declarations. So if you have an inductive type, which then you know, okay, it has this constructor, this, and this, and this, and you can read that as expression. So you have a more semantic understanding of how things go. You can also execute other meta programs. And then I have a very involved example for what there is no more time, and some final learning resources. So this thing is very good if you're primarily interested in the programming one. This one is for proving. And this one is very math heavy, very goes into depth on the type theory behind it all. Thanks for the talk. I'm open to questions.
Yes, so if you have questions, please raise your hand. I will come to you with a microphone and wait for me, so the people on the internet can also hear your question.
Hello? Okay. So I have two small questions. The first one is, does Lean have language level intersections or unions for types? Like you showed like OR types and AND types, but yes. These are kind of annoying to deal with sometimes because they're not really symmetric, and you have to swap things around sometimes and things like that. And some other languages have built-in union and intersection types for those.
The primitive in Lean are inductive types. AND, OR, and so on are all inductive types defined in the way roughly how I have shown on the slides. And that is the primitive. And I'm not sure if that answers the question.
I guess the answer is no, then. But yeah. The other question I'm not sure on which slide this was, but there was one time where the syntax in the function type, usually it, in most cases, it was like a parenthesis and then a name and then colon type. And in another case, it was curly braces instead of parentheses.
Oh, sorry, I forgot to explain that. The curly braces are an implicit parameter. So when you call that function, for example, you call add two of those vectors, then it's able to infer what n is because you know almost always what the type of the vector you pass in is. It is, for example, a 10 vector. And in that case, you don't want to write 10 as a separate parameter always. So it's able to be inferred. It's just implicit, basically syntax sugar.
I'd like to know whether there is some application domain you're aware of in which Lean would be a really poor choice of a programming language.
Poor choice. Probably high performance stuff. There is a lot of work being done on the Lean compiler itself to make it more performant, and it actually generates, and don't quote me on this, I think an LLVM compiler is, for example, in the works. I'm not sure if that's currently the way it is. It internally, it does reference counting in the generated code. But if I think, yeah, that's probably not the primary choice if you want to make something that really high performant to do it in Lean.
Yes, I was wondering if all this elaborator stuff, does it have some kind of notion of hygiene in terms of scoping? So for example, in the example you showed, there's a reference to, I think, an add function, but of course that depends, like if there's an add function in scope and where does that come from, how is that resolved?
Yes, macros are hygienic. There is a paper or several papers. It is essentially not an issue. I don't actually know how it's implemented. I don't think I can explain that to you, I'm sorry. It's just not an issue generally.
I was wondering if there's a linearity if there's a linearity concept like in IDRIS?
No, there is not.
Okay.
Sorry, short answer. although there has been a master thesis by someone who tried to add in-place rewriting to the Lean compiler. That is not part of the Lean type system, it's just in the generated code that you can erase some of the reallocations or some of the reference counting increments and decrements if you know that something is used linearly like. It's not enforced in a type system. You have to be a little bit careful in order to make sure that that is able to happen in the code generator. But yeah, in that sense, kind of yes and no, but not in a formal way.
You mentioned that the type has to be proven, or the function to be proven that it terminates?
Yes.
If I remember correctly, it's a long time ago, but how does it relate to Turing completeness of the language?
As far as I know, Lean is not fully Turing complete, although, I mean, you can have partial functions in Lean as well, but those you are not able to peek inside and reason about them. Yes.
Hi. Do you have ever worked with ECDA? And if so, what would you say are the difference? And if I have worked with ECDA before, would it be worth it to look into Lean as well?
ECDA has, as far as I know, no kernel or a very large kernel. So the amount of code that you need to trust is much larger than for Lean. ECDA has a lot of other amazing features, such as induction recursion, that Lean is not able to do. It also has a bunch of universes. I think it has omega universes that Lean doesn't have either. Stuff like that. Yeah, to some degree you can do that in Lean as well, but there are theoretical limits on that as well, unfortunately.
Are there any more hands that I missed? We have like time for two more questions probably. But if not, oh well, over there. And over here. Okay, so we have two questions and then.
How is the actual NAT type represented in the actual, like when you run the code? Is it able to actually optimize it, or are types like that special cased so that it doesn't actually represent it as like a linked list with no data in it and just pointer chasing?
Yeah, there are some special cases. NAT especially, it would be insane to do it as a linked list. So NAT is actually implemented using the GMP library, so it goes up until very large numbers very easily. It has no issue with that, yeah. Array is also implemented in a special way. There is a override in the code generator, so it is able to not implement it as a linked list, but as an actual array as well. So there are some special cases, but there are special cases, and not all types look that nicely.
Okay, anyone last? Then we're good. 1 minute early, but that's okay, I guess.
Yes.
So thank you very much for your wonderful talk. And